Welcome to the Global Development Institute podcast. Based at the University of Manchester, we're Europe's largest research and teaching institute addressing poverty and inequality. Each episode, we'll bring you the latest thinking, insights, and debate in development studies.
I should say this too. I really appreciate the time organization of this. I've done versions of this, but by and large, it seems everything has been 15 to 20 minutes. I sort of feel like it's a lot to pack in. So today I'm going to sort of do my deepest dive yet and really sort of mapping out my thinking on, you know, some of the issues in these supply chains pre-COVID and then what's happened since COVID and sort of try to get a little bit deeper into this. I think maybe for way of background, and I know, you know, my interest, like Stephanie's, very much is in global value chains, like global supply chains. I know the folks at this event think more broadly in terms of development. So I'm going to talk in broader context about development today. And to contextualize it and give you a little bit of background about myself, I studied in Boston. And when I was 21, I left the US and I moved to Latin America. And I began doing worker rights advocacy. I was first in Nicaragua, was later in El Salvador, years later for a period of time in Brazil. El Salvador was the country that really shaped me. And I went there in 1988. And there were some garment export factories in the country, but not much because the country was in the midst of a very violent civil war. And I was there sort of documenting some of the worker rights abuses. I did get into some garment factories then that had a big impact on my thinking. But what I want to emphasize is the country transitioned from war to peace, authoritarian rule to sort of more limited democracy in the early 90s. And the model for the country was to go all in on these export processing zones for garment exports. This was thought out very carefully. It was orchestrated between the government, USAID, World Bank. This was the model to rebuild this country in the post-war period. And at one point, you know, when I was living, the president said, let's turn this entire country into an export processing zone. Right? So these are zones where, largely through tax exemption, fabric was brought in, cut, sewn together, and re-exported. And while I was there, I began hearing accounts from workers. We had a worker rights research center that I hadn't heard of in other sectors. And it started with very long hours of work, but it also was the demographics of the workforce. Very young women, many from the countryside, talking about 12-hour shifts, talking about nights where they were told they weren't able to go home, they had to do overnight shifts. And I became very concerned. I've also became very intellectually curious. And since that time, we're talking 30 years now, I've been trying to understand the logic of this sector and why things are the way they are, and tracking dynamics and changes over time. So just to give you that context, this is a story about a development model that I think has failed many of these countries. And one of the reasons I'll say now too, as added to this, is we realized later, one of the issues was these agencies weren't just telling El Salvador to do this. They were simultaneously telling every single Central American country to do the same, get into garment exports, every single Caribbean country, Dominican Republic, Haiti, and so on, get into garment exports. And of course, in Asia, and even now to this day, as countries can transition, Myanmar goes from authoritarian rule to a limited democracy, do garment exports. Ethiopia starts to transition, do garment exports. And right there is the root of the problem. Instead of getting development, you get overcapacity. And so that's a big part of my thinking. Let me, with that, share my screen, if this, hopefully this will work, and sort of map out some of this. I've got to do slideshow. Is that showing up now? Everything, we're good? Okay. So let me, I organized my talk in four parts. First, I'm gonna talk about this, what I call the pre-COVID garment global supply chain squeeze and the causes and the consequences. So I'll spend some time discussing that. I will then go through the first phase of the crisis, the March 2020 buyer response to COVID and the lockdowns and these order cancellations that Stephanie was referring to. I'll then talk about the current crisis and some of my more recent research, which is about these declining orders, a really dramatic current squeeze on prices and a tremendous amount of uncertainty with new lockdowns and so on. And lastly, I'll sort of throw out some ideas, and this is really for discussion about, you know, fixing these supply chain problems. So this is my overall, this is just how I think and of the sector and what's going on. And my first diagram I'll put up on this. This is how I see the logic overall of this system. So you have a whole series of government and trade rules, national governments, international organizations, whether it's the phase out of the multi-fiber arrangement or a range of trade deals. You have financial deregulation happening. You have those development policies that I referred to, getting everybody into garment exports, labor dynamics, moving production to labor surplus economies. And what I see through those, again, starting with rules, decisions made by governments, two dynamics, buyer consolidation and increased purchasing mobility because of those changing trade rules. And on the other side, the growth and dispersion of the supplier base. And I argue that the result of those two dynamics is, let me get that right, buyer leverage over supplier increasing. I see that increasing over time. And we can get into some of the nuances. Yes, some suppliers have gotten larger, but the scale of the increase on the buyer side has surpassed that. So I see increased buyer leverage over time. I see that result in buyers. I'm talking about retailers, which would be like Walmart, and brands. So think of Nike or Gap and so on. I see dynamics, overall we can call them purchasing practices, but I would see a squeeze on price, what those buyers, those retailers and brands pay per unit to make a shirt, trousers and what have you, and other sourcing squeezes, which I will talk about. The result of all that, I then map out in purple, this is sort of the impact on workers, the wage squeeze, work intensity. I think it's an area that's under researched, but I'm trying to delve into that more. Building safety, we know about now as a result of Rana Plaza, but obviously many other incidents. Worker rights, the ability to form a union, bargain, strike, and so on. A squeeze down on all those aspects, but this is also related to a squeeze on environmental protections. And I would add, importantly, a squeeze on tax revenue. As I mentioned, these are largely tax-exempt models of production. These exporter free trade zones are largely tax-free zones. When you squeeze on taxes, as you push down on price, you're going to have a very adverse effect on the social protection, the government's ability to respond to crises and so on, as we're seeing now. So that's my overall model for this, with all the nuance you might see within that. What are some of the data points for this? Well, the biggest one, again, is the price squeeze. We see somewhat similar patterns. There's nuances for the European Union. I'm looking here at the US market. These are all apparel products coming in. And I simply took two different data series. One is the value of those imports, and then the other is the square meter amount. And I divide it, and you get the dollar per square meter. You can adjust for inflation over time. So this is a 30-year period. That's the price per square meter going into the US. So to annotate this a bit, this is the phase out of the multi-fiber arrangement, so the freeing of trade. But it's not just that this is where you had to go to Haiti with so many export quotas because South Korea was capped. So that whole system that kind of controlled trade in garments gets phased out over a 10-year period. But it's not just the phase out happens, it's what else goes on at the same time. And that includes, as the phase out is happening, China enters the WTO. This brings in only 25% of the world's workforce now are able to get into, portion of them into the garment export sector. And later that's followed by Vietnam entering the WTO. For the US, those are still the two largest garment exporters in the world. It's China, then Bangladesh, and then Vietnam. You have this spike, which is this kind of bizarre spike in cotton prices and some dynamics going on in India at the time. But otherwise you could see the price squeeze continues to go down. So very, very clear evidence on this price squeeze in real dollar terms over time. What's the impact of the price squeeze? Again, what does the evidence tell us? This is some research I started doing years ago, and later collaborated with Jen Baer and Jenny Blasi in an article we did on this. The blue bar is the price squeeze again. Here I just looked at the 20 top apparel exporters over time, and they change over time. It's every year, what were the 20 in each year? And the respect for workers' rights. And what we see is as the price gets squeezed down, the right to form a union and the right to bargain collectively get squeezed down as well. The violations of those rights go up. We also see it, of course, in wages. This is an older study done by the WRC and other collaborators. Prevailing wages as a percentage of living wage. Here we see some increases in China, we know about. Other countries stay flat. Bangladesh, 14% of prevailing wages, according to the study, covered the living wage expense. This is a photo I took visiting a factory in Bangladesh, and it caught my attention because it turns out that price tag, it was actually in many different currencies, but it came to about $68, and that was the minimum monthly wage at the time that she was working in that factory. So the price of the trousers was her wage for the month. Other purchasing practices, again, as I mentioned, this is not just about a price squeeze. Others that I focus on are order volume fluctuations. This is linked to fast fashion. But it's also, we see it now as a result of COVID. No one's quite knowing how to forecast. So sometimes orders spike up if they think something's going to sell and then go down again. The problem is, from an employment relations perspective, is a factory owner does not know how to allocate workforce. How many workers do you hire when this is what your order volume looks like over a period of time? So the tendency is going to be to hire on the low end, let's say 1,000 workers, because you don't want idle workers. And then when one spike comes in, that's when you get into the area of forced overtime. If it goes up enough, you might bring in contingent workers, pay them a lot of times off the books, cash payments to help with those peak orders. When it really spikes a lot, that's where you get into outsourcing and often unauthorized outsourcing. You call an uncle, a relative, somebody's in the business that you know, can you do, you know, help me with this part of my order? I need to meet these deadlines. So all this, these fluctuations as a result of the market fluctuations have very significant impacts on employment relations practices. The other element is speed to market. It's talked about a lot in fast fashion. I just want to emphasize here that it's not just about fast fashion. Even fashion basics is really obsessed with speed to market because it's about forecasting. If you place an order 9 months in advance thinking you're going to sell purple shirts and you're not quite sure purple shirt's going to be in style, you're a lot better if you can place that order 6 months or even 3 months in advance. So there's, because what if you miss, as we know, what happens is you sell that product with markdowns, and the industry is, you know, there's a lot of money that's potentially, for the industry perspective, lost due to markdowns. You get rid of those extra purple shirts by selling them at 40% off. So they become more and more obsessed with speed to market to avoid markdowns, again, across the industry. Lastly, I was just looking for free images that are free on the internet. I found this one, late payments. What we're seeing is the industry, the buyers, the brands and the retailers pushing later and later the point they pay the supplier from the moment they take possession of those goods, which is usually when the goods cross the bow of the boat. They take possession. It's perfectly possible on the banking system to release the funds at the moment you take possession of it. We'll see ahead. It used to be 30 or 60 days out. We're now looking at 90 to 120 days out with very, very adverse impacts on workers. Impact on work intensity. And this, again, I this is something I've been focusing on my recent research, especially in India recently. And I'll say this goes back to the very first time I visited a garment factory, which was in 1988 in El Salvador. And I go in, there was a union delegation arrived from Norway. They wanted to visit a factory. We get in and we're touring this factory. And I'm talking to the factory owner, and she tells me, I was asking, you know, what are some of her concerns and issues, that the minimum wage had just gone up by 10%. And the story is, and I've told this before, it's stuck in my head a lot because it's telling and it's relevant to this day, 30 years later. She was producing for Kmart, little girls' dresses. And at that time, Kmart sent her the fabric. So that wasn't part of her cost structure. So she calls Kmart headquarters and says, listen, there's been a change. You know, most of my expenses are labor cost, and labor cost just went up by 10%. I can't do these little dresses for a dollar a piece anymore. I need $1.10. And as you might anticipate, the response of Kmart was, you don't get how this works. We set the prices, not you. The price point is a dollar per piece. And if you can't do it at a dollar per piece, no problem. With one phone call, they told her, we can move this order to Haiti. So I'm looking around the factory as she's telling me the story, and the factory is just buzzing. So I said, well, obviously you figured out a way to get around this. What did you do? And her answer was, she went to the office, she got into the megaphone system and basically told all the workers they were going to have to work 10% faster. So you have these production quotas, you do 60 operations per hour, you're sewing 60 collars per hour. To keep your job, you now needed to do 66 operations. The problem is, that in itself is a problem. The problem is, imagine now taking that forward year after year after year. When I talk to workers, it's actually one of the first things, often before the wage issue, they talk about work intensity. So in India, what I was finding in this recent research, one of the interesting things is that they've gone from daily production targets, do 600 a day to keep your job, to hourly. And it was documented through the surveys I did, from 60 to 80 to even 100 operations per hour. 20% said they were doing at least 100 operations per hour. That gets to the point where it's no longer humanly sustainable, in my view. It's one of the reasons why you have this push for not just women workers, but very young women workers in the industry. And I saw this from El Salvador, the burnout age seemed to be around 25 years old. At that point, these workers just couldn't keep up anymore. So when you can't meet this inhumane production target, what then happens, and again, this was documented in the survey research, is an increase in verbal abuse. 64% of workers saying they were yelled at, most often for not meeting production targets. I later learned that in many of these factories, the line supervisor has her or his pay linked to the ability of that production line to meet quota. So there's an incentive system structured into this that contributes to that verbal abuse because the line supervisor wants to make his or her extra pay. So when the workers don't meet the quotas, they start yelling and often hitting the workers. Of course, there's a squeeze on fixed cost. Buildings are the biggest fixed cost. If your orders are going up and down, just like you want to keep your workforce allocations low, it pushes you into substandard building. Rana Plaza is the most dramatic example of that. But through my research, and this is in the article that Stephanie mentioned, we see an increase of both factory fires and building collapses over time as this price squeeze escalates. The squeeze on the environment, this is not my area of expertise, but it's certainly part of what's going on. As you push down on price, there is an incentive to cut corners on how you treat mainly the wastewater. And this is more in the case, obviously, of the textile component as opposed to the garment assembly or sewing component. But there's ample evidence for that, and more is being written about it. So those are sort of the main squeeze elements. Let me put up another diagram that I've been working on and trying to get my head around this. And a lot of my work, and you see the articles, I use this word squeeze. So I've been thinking about this squeeze down. But more recently, as I think about this squeeze down, I'm starting to think of the sucking up of value and how that works in supply chain. So here's another figure I want to put on that. We often, I start with myself included, we really start here with this is sort of the, our thinking of this, the lead firms, the brands and retailers and how they interact with the supplier factories. And we can go beyond garments or manufacturing, agriculture and mining, and how that results in a squeeze on workers, whether they're formal or informal. But the more we think about this, the more we realize that this is just part of the story. certainly, you know, above this is this whole question of finance, capital, private equity funds, shareholder, that pressure on lead firms for those constant returns, right, pushes the lead firms then to squeeze down their on their supply chain, right? You get quarterly reports and it's the cost of goods sold and profit margins. Well, the cost of goods sold is related to what you're paying down here and what you're paying your suppliers. So there's the financial component to it. So we got the squeezing down, and I think this is the sucking up, if you will, of the supply chain. So to fill this out more, and we know now that some of the richest people in the world, this is just Zara's, but we have many more examples, now worth $63 billion. I want to emphasize again, this doesn't just happen as a, you know, a natural result of the market. Governments made decisions that liberalized financial markets and contributed to this change. Just mapping this out a bit more, though, getting down to here, we've got these below subsistence wages and sort of how do workers survive and how does this model sort of come together? Well, these garment workers, they don't shop in supermarkets. They go to the informal sector. So they're buying their products in the marketplace, the rice, lentils, and so on. And here we have below subsistence income. We also, in many cases, and this is another piece of the story, migrant workers in the global north sending back remittances. And I've written on this before too, and I think it's very important when we look at the numbers for development, what's going on. I've seen reports say, well, garment employment in Bangladesh has increased by so much and poverty in Bangladesh has gone down by so much. And it looks like a very simple correlation, a very positive correlation, more garment jobs, less poverty. The problem I had with those studies was some of them were doing that at a time when the garment workers were making $39 a month. And the metrics for poverty was $2 a day was $60 a month. So this created a puzzle for me. How do you pay $39 a month and reduce poverty if the poverty rate is you have to be above $60 a month? And the answer to me to that puzzle was remittances. A lot of these studies are not looking at the impact of remittances. And not that I'm saying remittances are a good thing. I think people, you know, that people for failed economic policies are forced to leave, but the amount of money coming in remittances far exceeds in case after case after case the amount of total income from the salaries in the garment sector. Most essential American, the Caribbean, over 10% of GDP is in remittances. Bangladesh, when you look at the total value of payroll for garment workers, remittances are about 2.5 times that. And remittances, as we know, is poor people sending money to poor people. So my argument is it's not so much that these garment workers are making such wages that are above poverty, it's that so much is coming in remittances. And we know a lot of these workers get by each month because the garment workers themselves are getting remittances. My point here, though, is all this and when I think of the sucking up, just think of a huge vacuum over the room sucking up. You first start sucking value out of those direct workers, but you actually really are starting to suck value out of those informal sector workers where the factory workers buy their goods, and you're sucking value from those remittances that are going up the supply chain. We can also add a lot of these governments through tax exemptions and even subsidies for drawback and so on, that is getting sucked up. So at the end of the day, you've got a system where garment workers are making 38 cents an hour. Whoops, I'm going in the wrong direction. And you have Amazon, today I checked, the market valuation is $106 trillion. This to me is the full picture, the squeezing down on labor in all its manifestations and the sucking up of value. So with all that, to me, my point is this is my understanding, my data, my research, with so many other folks doing great research, the situation of these garment supply chains prior to COVID and the lockdowns. What happens with COVID? Well, I think the story now is well known, and Stephanie referenced it. You had dramatic order cancellations. And for me, I know there's nuances, there's case studies and big suppliers that have power, but for me, if anyone had any doubts of where the power rests in these supply chains, COVID gave us the answer. Buyers across the board, brands and retailers, abruptly canceled orders without paying for them. So they tell a factory, make 100,000 shirts for me and I will pay you $300,000, you know, 6 months later. That factory buys the fabric, cuts the fabric, sews it together, gets the thread, the buttons, packages it up, pays the workers, hopefully the wages, and is ready to ship. And they're so, you know what, we don't want it anymore. Force majeure, act of God, COVID is an act of God. Our contractual obligations, we no longer need to meet them because this was an act of God. So this, and in this case, it's interesting. I get approached by the Bangladesh Garment Associations, and they asked to, you know, they explained the situation to me and asked if there was something that I could do. And I said, well, the only thing I know how to do is research. If you give me access and we can do a survey and give me access to some of your internal databases on these, I'll write it up. And that's what I did. And it wouldn't have been possible without that support. And as Stephanie also mentioned, the Worker Rights Consortium helped a lot. So we did this report, it came out late March, and I'll explain, we did a couple versions of it in the end, and it was called Abandon, the Impact of COVID-19 on Workers and Businesses at the Bottom of Global Supply Chains. And this is what we were able to document in that report. First off, just the levels of cancellations. At that time, roughly in those months, in Bangladesh, it was $3.1 billion of orders were canceled, just straight out. Orders in process, had been canceled with no payment. And we extrapolated from that and estimated $40 billion globally had been canceled without payment. We list, and I'll get back to this important decision we made, we actually got into the data and listed company by company just for Bangladesh. And this was only the top, 14 or so that were over 20 million in cancellations, but it was an incredibly long list. So we asked, these are the survey questions. We asked questions such as, after the cancellation, did the buyer pay for raw material costs, the fabric? And 72% said no. We asked after the cancellations, did the buyer pay for the production cost, workers sewing the garments together? 91% said no. We asked, did the buyers help with furlough pay? In this case, referring to if you get temporarily sent home for a period of time as they cancel the orders, 98% said no. We asked, did the buyers help with severance pay if it resulted in a permanent dismissal? 97% said no. The impact on workers, we asked, and this is a question, we're asking the factory owners this, right? This is not a survey of the workers, but the factory owners. And we said, did you, when you sent workers home temporarily, did you provide furlough pay? And the factory owners responded, 72% said no. We asked, did you, when you permanently fired a worker, did you provide severance pay? 80% said no. So in Bangladesh, and we put this in the report, we documented over 1 million workers being adversely affected. Now, it could have been these fired workers. There were other ways they could have been adversely affected, dramatic reduction in working time and other things. But in one way or another, they were adversely affected. And again, as you know, we would anticipate from Stephanie's work and others, these are mostly young women workers. Many of them are migrants from internal migrants from the countryside of Bangladesh. Just to put this up, it's some of the impact of this. I've said this before. I don't know how many years it took me to write my dissertation, and if eight people read it, I'd be surprised. I wrote this report in 8 days, and it was 8 pages long, and the response was pretty dramatic. And this was someone, I deleted the names here, but this is from Inditex writing me when it was March 31. You say, okay, we read your report. You said we canceled 109 million. We can now, you know, confirm we're going to pay up everything. Can you please remove us from your report, just like you removed H&M and PVH? So this led then to follow-up calls. Okay, let's talk about this. And it's two things I was saying, and I want to emphasize just how much the Worker Rights Consortium collaborated on this and really took it forward afterwards with other brands. Well, two things. One, okay, you're saying this, but we need to confirm it, which means I am going to write all the context, not just in Bangladesh, but elsewhere, Cambodia, Ethiopia, Latin America, to say, is Inditex paying up now? That was one. The other was, I said, okay, this is great. The report I wrote was on Bangladesh as an illustration, but certainly you would not be suggesting that you would only be paying up what you owe for Bangladesh. This has to be, you know, what you owe up globally. And this is only a fraction of that. So we had to have, we had these back and forth discussions, and then we did confirmation. And as we confirmed, we did remove folks, and we eventually led to this tracker online, because the changes were happening every week. And you could see that the Worker Rights Consortium tracker is still active, and we're still updating it. Primark was one of the last ones, but we did add them to the positive side of the tracker for paying up. Okay. So what our estimate now, as I mentioned earlier, we calculate about 40 billion canceled orders. We're estimating now that at least $22 billion has been paid up. This is a news article on that. Okay, so now, where are we now? That was March, April, June, July, when the payups were happening. Enormous campaign, hashtag payup, did tremendous work on that. It's clear to me, it's not, and the report only does so much. It's organizations then taking it and doing all the stuff they do on social media and Instagram and so on. So very, very, very large campaign, a lot of great media reporting. Where are we now? And this is, you know, I sort of saw this coming. I deliberately waited a bit to do the second report. What I anticipated happening is you had that big drop right when the first lockdowns hit. But then the orders would start to look like they were going back up again. But that was the pay up and getting old orders done. What concerned me going forward was the decline in new orders. And there's only so much you can say about that when you're campaigning. If consumers are facing new lockdowns and not buying clothing, how do you tell the brand, no, buy 100,000, just like you bought 100,000 shirts last year, buy 100,000 shirts again. There's only so much you could say about that, but we still wanted to document it. And what was really something you can say something about is what's going on with prices, what's going on with payment terms and other things. So here are some of the results from that more recent survey. This is the new report came October 16th, leveraging desperation, apparel brands purchasing practices during COVID. So here's the order volume story. Again, very dramatic. You see the significant cuts, only a small, 19% said they had low levels of cuts, but you start to see these very, very high levels of, this is the bigger cuts. This is only 1% said they had more orders now. But so very significant cuts in order volume. This is what really got my attention. I put this up, this is actually the trade data. In the survey data, it came out as 12% price decline. Now the average year-on-year price decline, if you look at that original chart I did going back 30 years, the average year-on-year price decline is 2.3%. So this is far and above the normal squeeze, 13%, looking at per unit July 19 going into the US, no control here for inflation, it's a one-year period, and July 2020, squeezing down on price. And we'll talk more about it, but the point here is if I said there was a power imbalance between buyers and suppliers, and that the system had been set up in such a way with overcapacity that it was a buyer's market, it is that much more of a buyer's market now, because the suppliers are all desperate for orders and the competition went from, you know, hyper to super hyper, and they're taking advantage of that. And I'll show you a quote from a CEO basically acknowledging that. Here's the other point. I think it's not studied as much as it should be, but this question of payment terms. So the blue bar is telling you the payment terms in 2019. This is again the survey findings. You know, when did you get paid after you completed orders? So you had, you know, a number here, 16%, again, looking at the blue bar, but most were really in this range, 30, 45, 60 days. This is the period where most were getting paid pre-COVID. Now, what are these brands and retailers doing? You see some getting there, but it's shifted all the way over to 60, 90, 120 days out. From the point they take possession of the product, they're paying 120 days later. We even have 5% paying 180 days out. When you averaged it all out before COVID in 2019, the average factory owner supplier waited 43 days to get paid after they shipped an order. They are now waiting 77 days to get paid. And the impact, this is an industry that is very dependent on cash flow, because you need that cash to buy the fabric for your next order, because that, you know, your, that money is not going to be paid up front. So the impact is right here. You know, what does this all mean on the likelihood of going out of business? So at the top, the more positive, extremely unlikely, somewhat unlikely. What we see here is just the majority saying somewhat likely or extremely likely. And the breaking point for a lot of them at the time they seem to be suggesting was about 3 months out. If conditions continue, the decline in order volume, the squeeze down on price and the delays in payment terms, this was the point where they would have to consider going out of business. Impacts on workers. Well, I added this in there because I think it's important. Some of the research findings, even some of the factory owners are saying, well, you know, our employment level is, it's not like we fired half all of our workers, but we do see dramatic reductions in working times. Workers are just working less because of this decline in order volume. So we could see that here in these reductions. However, there was a reduction in employment levels. And I just asked in the survey, what was your employment level on January 1? What is it? What was it in June? And 62% said they had a decrease. 26% said no change. 12% had an increase. And most of those cases was because they were doing personal protective equipment. At this, from that point to that point, what I found, the average, there was a 10% reduction in employment. Now, I referenced in the report a very conservative figure for employment in the garment sector. So just looking at garments, not textiles, not footwear, not the broad network, as I should have, informal homework and so on, 35 million is the figure I've to document country by country. 35 million workers get up every day and are working in these factories. So when you talk about a 10% decline, you're talking about 3.5 million workers out of work, separate from the reduction in hours. So other impact, we have the reduction in hours, the increase in health and safety concerns. One of the questions I asked was the factory owners, did your buyers, the brands and retailers, allow for some degree of flexibility in shipment times as you adjusted for COVID and social distancing within the factories? And a significant number said no. In fact, some said, they said, you have to ship them Friday, whatever the date is, ship it at this time, that's the deadline. They're more obsessed, as I mentioned earlier, about speed to market because they're unable to forecast long-term. So they don't want delays. So some said they were actually, as they tried to adjust for COVID with social distancing, there was a delay. As a result of the delay, the buyers hit them with a fine because it's in their production contract. If you're late, you pay a fine. So the concerns about health and safety for these workers is really quite significant. Here's another point I think is under research. I'm hearing this through interviews. It wasn't something I was able to document in the survey, so I should emphasize that. The increase in short-term work contracts. So what I'm hearing through interviews is that a lot of factories are dismissing the permanent workers and then rehiring them on these short-term contracts. And the reason, of course, they're doing that is because there's no forecasting. The buyers are going, okay, forget about 100,000 units. Maybe have a sense what I can sell next month. So give me 20,000 and get it to me really quickly. And then you don't know, what's going to happen next. So all those issues of workforce allocation I mentioned earlier are greatly amplified. This change in the contracts from sort of more permanent work to more precarious work doesn't show up in employment figures. Someone can say we still, we're at 90% employment, but there's a dramatic change going on in the terms of employment that's not being captured in that. And I think that needs to be more carefully researched. And lastly, we've got, this is BRAC, one of the biggest NGOs in Bangladesh, came up with a report recently saying that we have rising levels of malnutrition among garment workers and their families. And in their survey they found, it was a very large survey of workers, 77% of workers now are struggling to feed their families. There are reports in The Guardian and elsewhere, interviews with workers saying that they've been living for 1 month off of a sack of rice. Okay, so that was my more recent research. The question then becomes, fixing this, but maybe first to say, you know, what's next? Where are we heading with all of this? So let me give you some possible scenarios going forward. There's a more pessimistic view of the future if things weren't bad enough already. We could see even more buyer consolidation. The ones that were able to stay open during the pandemic, e-commerce, Amazon, mass merchandisers that sold food as well as garments, Walmart, will gain dramatic market share and increase their control. Their leverage will go up, while others will go into bankruptcy. And this is not just, you know, this is going on as we speak. You could see it in market valuation. These companies have entered into bankruptcy. At least a dozen, maybe 15 well-known, recognized names like JCPenney and Sears have gone into bankruptcy during the pandemic. Consumer demand stays flat for a whole bunch of reasons. Even as we come out of the pandemic, this question of just changing work patterns and how many of us are going to continue to work from home and so on. So you have supplier competition for a limited number of orders will escalate, and we'll see an increase in the squeeze and a deepening of the crisis of overcapacity. And of course, workers will face the greatest consequences of all of this. In my survey, I did ask this question, which was, okay, it's 10% drop in employment. However, if these conditions continue, what will your employment levels be 3 months from now? And they were saying 35% total, not added onto the temp, 35%. So again, do the math, you're talking 35 million workers, 10 million workers possibly losing their jobs. A squeeze on public resources, again, something else I think we need to study more, at least I do, maybe others have. Drop in economic activity always leads to a drop in tax revenue, but we're already seeing discussions of these supplier countries saying we have to reduce taxes even more, increase tax exemptions to compete. And of course, what does this do? It robs states of revenue for social protection. This, just to give you a sense, and I said, you know, not just speculation, there was, I listened in onto the reporting by, this is Carter's company, they do Oshkosh, and they were asked by a major institutional investor, basically, you know, do we keep investing in you? You know, you seem to be in crisis here. What's your forecast for the future? And this is how the CEO responded. Thankfully, given a more favorable environment for input cost and the excess manufacturing capacity in Asia, we are forecasting lower product cost for spring 2021. The crisis of overcapacity will deepen. There will be hyper competition among these suppliers in crisis, and we're going to take advantage of that by paying them less, right? Excess manufacturing capacity, lower production cost. However, he adds, our expectation that product costs will be lower, we have no plans to lower prices in the spring. So none of those savings are going to be transferred over to consumers. We're still going to charge consumers what we've been charging them for the Oshkosh goods and so on. And as a result of this, our gross margins will expand going forward. We will make more money. We'll have a higher margin in the crisis. Possible winners among the suppliers, I only have a couple slides to go, so we'll turn it over to Q&A. The larger suppliers in Bangladesh could come out. It's a dangerous game right here because, you know, the crisis goes a bit deep. They could come out okay. How so? They'll pick up orders leaving China, because orders are leaving China, and that's a lot of orders. So they could take advantage of that. And they could, I say the largers, they could pick up orders from small and medium-sized enterprises. They'll go out of business first. They already are. But that's a dangerous game. So for a period of time, it might look good for you. But if the crisis goes a bit longer, like only a month or two longer, the larger suppliers will also be squeezed out of business. The other is, we're hearing this push towards nearshoring. I participate whenever I can on these conferences that the sourcing folks do and so on. And you ask them, what's the future? So, well, we got to make the push even greater and more quickly to nearshoring and automation. So if that's true, you're talking about maybe an increase in production in Turkey for Europe. I'm not sure Latin America for the US, but that's what they're talking about. Whether that happens, I don't know. But those would, again, just trying to speculate who the possible winners would be among supplier countries. And of course, this leaves many losers. All of this, you know, means a net loss in employers, employment. As I mentioned, you know, going from 10 to 35% going forward. And just to end, I mean, this is, you know, learning a lot from Gary Dureffy's work and Stephanie and others, this, you know, the question of governance. And I think what holds the most promise is public and social governance. Public governance, we certainly need, you know, more laws and enforcement from the producer countries, the supplier countries in terms of social protection, industrial policy, and their tax regimes. In consumer country public governance, you know, rethinking of trade agreements, these binding due diligence laws, which are starting to grow, greater regulation on the financial markets, you know, all these things that sort of unleash this dynamic in the supply chain need to be addressed at the top. Internationally, multilateral trade regimes, right? The whole development policies, as I mentioned, we have to get to the point where we stop this obsession with the four East Asian countries from the 1950s and 60s. Four of them did apparel and they developed. Therefore, everybody can simultaneously do garment exports and you'll get development. You don't get development. You get overcapacity and a squeeze on prices. So we have to think a little bit more creatively about development policies and more diversified developments, it seems. The questions around international standards. Enforcement of purchasing contracts. You know, one factory owner said, you know, I thought I had a contract with the buyer. It turns out it was just an invoice, you know, something. You know, the contract, actually, they think there's something binding when they say, I will pay you $300,000 for those shirts. So there's a rethinking of how contracts are written, so they're actually stronger. And so on. Social governments get in sort of into the labor side. I've been a fan and others have done tremendous work on this, including the Fair Work Foundation and the graduate students that I've worked with. Total costing for decent work and sustainable development. When you set that price point, whether it's a dollar for a dress or $3 for a shirt, that price point has to cover living wages, safe works, taxes, and so on. And that system of total costing for decent work and sustainable development has to be embedded in enforceable and binding commitments with co-governance, where labor as well as suppliers and buyers are on the board of that. So, okay, sorry. That's all I have. Thank you.